You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 17th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio.
G7 foreign ministers consider their response to Iran's attack on Israel while kind of hoping Israel won't respond at all. The mayor of Ukraine's second city wonders where his multinational air defence umbrella is. And Turin and the UK seek to further ostracise smokers, if by different means. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to The Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Alyona Hlivko and Sir Laurie Bristow, will discuss the day's big stories. On this day, historical series, we'll recall one of the worst ideas in American foreign policy history, and we'll hear from our team at Salone del Mobile in Milan. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on The Monocle Daily. This is The Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Alyona Hlivko, former regional Ukrainian MP, now the managing director of the Henry Jackson Society, a foreign policy think tank that advocates for liberal democracy, the rule of law, and the market economy, and also by Sir Laurie Bristow, president of Hughes Hall College at the University of Cambridge, previously the UK's ambassador to Afghanistan, Russia, and Azerbaijan. Hello to you both.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Laurie, your first time on the Daily, and as is customary, we have made you dress as an owl. But once you've got past that and once you've adjusted to the wings, introduce yourself briefly to our listeners, if you would.
Well, thanks for the invitation. I think you just did introduce me. So I've been in back in Cambridge for the last 18 months after 32 years in the diplomatic service. My time in the Foreign Office was bracketed by the end of the Cold War and the beginning of what's happening now, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Some fairly exciting things along the way. But what I mostly work on these days is the geopolitics of the mess that we're in the world today, where we think things go next with Russia, in Russia, and some of the moving tectonic plates in the world.
Listeners will also be well aware, but that we observe a rigorous tradition of allowing our guests to absolutely mercifully cane any books they have out or coming up. We will be talking about yours in greater depth on a daily in a few weeks. But if you want to tell people what the title is and when they can find it.
So it's out this week, and the title is Kabul Final Call. It was a photograph I took in Dubai Airport on route to Kabul in June 2021. 12 weeks later, I was on one of the last flights out of Kabul after the collapse of the government, the collapse of a 20-year campaign in Afghanistan, and the awful scenes that followed in the airport. The book's about what happened, but also, more importantly, why it happened.
Alyona, we will be talking about Ukraine, sort of, a bit later in the show, but you have been working on Ukraine/UK-related stuff.
I have been indeed, and it's very exciting that the United Kingdom, having been the first partner and supporter of Ukraine ever since the first and the second invasion of Ukraine, is quite steadfast in its support towards Ukraine. So the strategic partnership agreement that was signed between Ukraine and the UK in 2020 and the UK-Ukraine security agreement that was signed in January this year is going to have its extremely exciting for me as a Ukrainian extension, and it will go into a 100-year partnership that was initiated and ideated by Lord Cameron when he was visiting President Zelensky in January. So I'm very excited to be contributing to that partnership agreement and seeing where these two countries can build their alliance even further.
Well, more on Ukraine shortly, but we will start in the Middle East, and it is not yet clear exactly how Israel plans to respond to the weekend's missile and drone barrage launched at it by Iran, but it is becoming clear that respond Israel will. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has rebuffed private and public entreaties from Israel's allies to call it a draw. In the meantime, a meeting of G7 foreign ministers on Capri is pondering economic retaliation against Iran in the form of further sanctions sanctions on top of those to which the Islamic Republic is already subject. Laurie, first of all, as I was saying, we don't know yet how Israel plans to respond, although Israel is saying it will. What would actually be the smart thing for Israel to do at the moment? Would the smart thing to be to maintain such moral high ground as it holds?
Yeah. So I think we're at a very important set of turning points, which are interlinking with each other in some pretty unpredictable ways. Maybe first start with, you know, what are sanctions about? What are they for? I think we know from, you know, the Russia example that, I mean, sanctions will not in themselves solve the problem for you. What they may well do is create pressures, create resource constraints, forced poor choices in your adversary. But what they also do is signal, and they signal to some very important audiences. One, of course, is Iran. One is Israel. Another is our domestic opinion here and elsewhere about what we want to see happen here. So in terms of, you know, what the turning point is, there's a really big set of questions here now for everyone. Israel, Iran, us, the whole lot. It really comes down to what is your next move? What are you trying to achieve at what cost and risk? And you know, what's your calculation there? So to unpack a bit some of what that's about, of course, what everyone wants to do is deter Iran from attacking Israel, from using its proxies in the Middle East to attack Israel and Israel's interests and allies, including ours. Israel wants to get its hostages back. It wants to neutralize Hamas as a military force. I would say it also needs to dig itself out of the hole it's in Gaza. I don't see a way for Israel essentially to secure itself in the long term unless it can find a way out of that morass. We all need to satisfy domestic pressures, but above all, we also all need to address the urgent and extreme humanitarian situation in Gaza. So turning to the Americans, who've been very active in the last few days, what the Americans essentially want to do is to achieve the first step towards a de-escalation, so a ceasefire, release of prisoners, but also getting aid into Gaza to address, you know, the things that unless they happen, this is going nowhere. They will not want to see that derailed. So what I expect to see is a great deal of behind-the-scenes manoeuvring to try to get Israel to understand that the choice really is dig this hole deeper or start looking for an exit ramp.
And you know, your country, of course, is under attack by a country which, because of that, has had many sanctions imposed upon it by the West. They have not, obviously, stopped Russia from besetting Ukraine. Do you have any faith that they do actually work, that they have any deterrent effect, or are they, as I often suspect, a way of saying you've done something short of actually doing anything?
Well, indeed, before all the Russian sanctions were imposed on Russia, Iran was the most sanctioned country in the world for some period of time. I guess in terms of signaling and talking to the internal audiences and making an effect on international stage, it was making some effect. However, we have seen that these malign actors and states have learned very well of how to go around these sanctions, how to evade them and create all sorts of loopholes. And we can only see that with Iran rearming itself, with getting more potentially ballistic missiles from Russia in exchange of the drones that they've been supplying Russia with, rearming and creating its own nuclear arsenal, that these sanctions simply don't work. So I'm not sure how effective the new set of sanctions will be unless we address and realistically address the loopholes that exist for sanction evasions. Because, for example, for Russia, we all know that Russia is still selling oil to India as the number one importer of Russian crude oil and then selling it off to the West, just processed. So when are we actually going to start talking about it honestly and start closing the loopholes?
Laurie, on the ambassadorial / diplomatic front, and this is something I have wondered about, not just about Iran, but about Russia as well. Why do we simply not just throw their embassies out?
You mean the Russian embassy or the Iranian embassy?
Both.
Yeah. So this is a really good question. It comes up regularly. throwing out ambassadors, throwing out embassies is always an option. And I was in Moscow during 2018 when the GRU sent two hitmen to the UK to kill a Russian dissident, you know, using...
Indeed. I wondered at the time why we still have diplomatic relations with a country that would do that.
So the key thing to bear in mind here is that when you're dealing with a country like Russia or Iran, you don't have an embassy there because you like them or agree with them. You know, the fundamental, irreducible job of an ambassador in a relationship like that is to do two things. One is to make sure that your government back home understands with crystal clarity what is happening in the country that you're working in, why they're doing what they're doing, what's like they're likely to do next, and what, if any, influence you have over that. But it's also to pass messages very clearly. It, certainly in the case of Russia, in my experience, it's a big mistake to rely on Russian officials, particularly Russian ambassadors, to pass a clear, unalloyed message back into the decision makers in the Kremlin. You need your person on the spot to do that. But if at any stage, you know, that all becomes simply undeliverable, then, yeah, you know, you need to ask, where is this relationship going?
Just a final thought before we move on to Ukraine. And by way of getting this there, Aliona, among those attending the G7 gathering on Capri is Ukraine's Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba. Will he be trying to pitch, as I know Ukraine has before, the idea that this is all ultimately kind of one fight? This is the democratic West versus the not. Do you think Ukraine is getting anywhere making that case?
Unfortunately, with all of the understanding that currently exists within the G7 countries, G20 countries, NATO alliances, you name it, all the Western democratic alliances that currently exist in the world, clearly understanding what's at stake in Ukraine, it seems that not everyone is ready to dedicate more military and financial aid simply because it's slipping the media agenda. As sad as it sounds, with all the elections going on across the world, and especially in the United States, who are crucial to supplying aid to Ukraine, it's just very difficult to make the case heard. But going back to Iran, we have to understand that this is not going to be the final incident where, you know, Israel will be restrained from taking retaliatory action towards Iran, and this conflict will die down from emerging into a wider regional one. We have to be prepared that Iran, through its proxies or now through direct military attacks from its own military and government, it will keep hitting Israel and going against the West just because it's now aligned with Russia, potentially North Korea and China. So it's a growing axis of evil, as we keep calling it in the media, that the West definitely needs to address.
Well, let's move along from a country which has helped demonstrate what modern air defences are capable of to the country which has been left to demonstrate what happens when those air defences are absent. Ihor Tarakov, the mayor of Ukraine's second biggest city, Kharkiv, has said that his city faces going the way of Syria's second biggest city, Aleppo, if American aid to Ukraine remains stuck in the House of Representatives. In recent weeks, Russia has stepped up raids on Kharkiv, targeting energy infrastructure in a fairly transparent attempt to render the city unlivable. Kharkiv, close to both the Russian border and the Ukrainian oblasts illegally annexed by Moscow, appears to be Russia's current principal strategic preoccupation. First of all, Aliona, I wanted to ask, is there any way to explain how this, and by this I mean that extraordinary multinational effort launched over the weekend to defend Israel, looks to Ukrainians? We did hear from President Zelensky earlier. He said it demonstrated how truly effective unity in defending against terror can be when it is based on sufficient political will. I mean, you don't need much of an advanced degree in reading between the lines to perceive the frustration there.
Oh, it is so heartbreaking. As a Ukrainian, I was watching all those 301 missiles and drones getting shot down over Israel, rejoicing that no human life will be lost. Fair enough, they were giving it enough advance and clearly were trying to avoid further escalation at that particular point. But Ukrainian city like Kharkiv or Odessa or Zaporizhia or even the western ones where I come from get targeted with that barrage of missiles and drones produced by Iran or North Korea every single day. And it's really heartbreaking, the double standards coming from the West, whereas, okay, we are allies and partners of Israel, so it's okay for us to get engaged in the war there. But when it comes to Russia, all of a sudden the nuclear threat comes up as this big existential thing that everyone is scared of. But Iran has potentially already developed nuclear missiles. So where is it? Who's going to be the first one to blink? So far, it's been the West.
Laurie, Aliona has already partially answered the question by invoking Russia's nuclear deterrent, but it does seem like a fair question to ask in the current context. We clearly can shoot down everything Iran launches at Israel. Why do we not do the same for what Russia launches at Ukraine?
I mean, the contrast is pretty shocking, as Aliona has spelled out. Maybe to help your listeners understand a bit more about some of the things going on here. I mean, there's a very interesting thing happened in the Iranian attack in Israel on Israel, which was that actually part of the response involved Jordan and certain other Arab states. They didn't
Indeed
do that.
So.
They didn't do that, because they fundamentally agree with what Netanyahu's government is doing in Gaza. Quite the opposite. They did it because it was in their interests. Because it is not in their interests for Iran to be able to use force freely across the Middle East against Israel or against them. You know, this is a multi-level conflict. So turning to the question of deterrence, I think the whole story in Ukraine over the last 2 years has been plagued by too little, too late, sometimes with arguable reasons. I mean, one of the things we were very concerned about in the West in the early stages of the war was managing escalation with the world's largest nuclear power. I think we're way beyond that argument now. I mean, we are in a situation where it's very, very clear that there is no interest in Russia any more than there is in NATO, in a direct Russia-NATO confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what we're looking at here is each side testing out the willpower of the other side as well as the capabilities of the other side. Now, turning to why this is happening, a big part of it is the fact that $61 billion program, the latest assistance package, is stuck in the Congress, in the U.S. Congress. And I think there are essentially two reasons for that. One is political maneuvering ahead of the U.S. election later this year. The other, I would say, is lack of strategic clarity amongst some members of Congress about what is at stake here. The stakes for U.S. interests could hardly be higher. So what's happening now? The Ukrainian armed forces are trying to hold off sustained Russian assaults with not enough ammunition, not enough equipment, not enough air cover, the ability to shoot down Russian planes and missiles. Russia can perfectly well see that situation and is seizing the opportunity. So what they're trying to do is destroy as much infrastructure as possible, targeting things like civilian power stations. They're probing Ukrainian defences to see where the weaknesses are for what will almost certainly be another Russian assault this summer. But they're also trying to demoralise Ukrainians and Ukraine supporters, essentially to persuade us that this defensive war that Ukraine is conducting is unwinnable. We cannot allow that to happen.
Well, to focus that question on the city of Kharkiv, Aliona, if the Russians were to take Kharkiv or if a plurality of its citizens were compelled to abandon it, I mean, both strategically and in terms of morale, that would be quite hard for Ukraine to come back from, wouldn't it?
Mm. The way it's being described in Ukrainian intelligence circles and media is that Russia's number one objective is to definitely make the city almost obsolete for most of the residents to just leave it, abandon it, make it a ghost town, and then eventually turn it into, as you mentioned, Aleppo or Mariupol, Avdiivka, Bakhmut, you name it, all the other little towns in Ukraine. But this one, with one exclusion, will be a million people city that used to be a capital of Ukraine in Soviet Union. So it's a very well developed with its own intelligentsia, with very specific, peculiar culture and contribution to Ukrainian nationhood of people. We have so many writers and authors and poets, one of whom the most prominent one, Serhiy Zhadan, who's now... He's one of the best modern writers of Ukraine, and he's gone onto the front line. So it just shows you how critical the situation is in the city. And I hear news from my friends who still are there and are not giving up that it is getting quite critical and quite scary because the city is getting targeted every day. And of course, it doesn't help the Russian messages, whether it's propaganda or the warning or prophecy of talking about invading and occupying the city and making it a Russian city yet again. So it's all quite troubling, but I hope that Ukrainian troops will hold the city. There's certainly a strong defense around it, everywhere around Liman, which Russians are still fighting for, and Siversk and Bilohorivka, all the little villages that were fought off last year. They're still holding ground, and I can say that from experience because that's where my brother is now, defending Ukrainian soil and doing it quite successfully. So despite the disparage in lack of ammunition and not many professional soldiers on the ground because of the lack of people, because we have lost so many people so far, they're still holding the ground. And I don't think we will lose Kharkiv soon enough, but the situation is quite dire. And as Laurie rightly mentioned, it all depends on the US aid.
Well, let's look at Australia now. And Australia's trepidation about China has been a pretty constant theme of the last 2.5 centuries or so. The current strain of that concern is manifest in a new national defence strategy, 80 pages of sobering reading about the deteriorating security environment of the Pacific and the urgency of the need for Australia to rise to it by spending a great deal of money on defence. The review notes, however, that this is not defence as in defence of the homeland, a vast remote island fortress can kind of take care of itself, but defence of Australia's interests, heavily maritime as they are. Laurie, reading this as an Australian, there does seem something almost quaint about it. Australia has roughly the population of Shanghai. Is there really realistically much that Australia can do to deter China as such?
I don't think there's anything quaint about it at all. I think the Australians are conducting exactly the same analysis that the rest of us are doing and are coming to similar conclusions. So, you know, a few elements of that. I mean, first of all, you know, it's recognised the world we're in. Mm. You know, as I said at the beginning, I joined the Foreign Office in the year that the Cold War ended. That's part of the reason I joined the Foreign Office. But we have to recognise that we are now back in an era of, well, let's call it politely, great power competition. And, you know, in some cases, military competition mm-hmm. between great powers. So any remaining illusion that we could take and hold on to that peace dividend from the end of the Cold War, it's gone. That's not the world we're in. We've also moved out of the period of our enterprises, let's call them that, in Afghanistan and Iraq. I worked on both of them, Iraq at the beginning of the invasion and Afghanistan right at the end. We're now in a world, though, of these huge tectonic shifts going on as well. So in parallel with those things, other things happening around the change in the way that economic power works in the world. I mean, China, you know, by some measures is, you know, it's one of the world's top two economies. It's not all as rosy it would have looked a couple of years ago, but it is a big fact of life in the modern world. Technological change is moving apace, and it's changing the way that states and societies relate to each other. The rules-based international order itself, so the whole network of treaties, of institutions that allow us to manage disagreement and maximize cooperation where we can do that, that's also under a risk, I would say. So what the Australians are doing is looking very, very hard at where are their alliances, where are their interests, and how they work more effectively in that world. Just before I stop, and there are a couple of other things to bear in mind here. One is the growth of multi-alignment, flexible geometries. So Australia, of course, has been a long-standing partner of the UK, the Americans, through, for example, the Five Eyes Alliance, or going back through their involvement alongside our troops in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere. But they're also teaming up through things like the Indo-Pacific Quad with the Japanese, the Indians, the US, you know, to look at where the alignments of interest are, where the future alliances lie. And, of course, crucially working with the Americans and us on the next generation of nuclear-powered submarines, essentially to keep those sea lanes open. My very last point, I mean, it's a region that from this part of the world, you can sometimes forget the size and importance of the unresolved conflicts. So Taiwan, the Korean Peninsula, and the one that everybody forgets about. Russia and Japan have no peace treaty from 1945. Just think about that.
Leona, one fundamental problem that Australia is having, and it's not unusual to Australia in the modern democratic developed world, which still is very, well, in, almost entirely reliant now on volunteer militaries, is that for all Australia indulges in immense sentimental veneration of its armed forces, they do rather struggle for people who actually want to join their armed forces. The Australian Defence Forces are about 7% short of fully staffed, which is about 4,500 people. Is this something, and I suspect I know which way opinion in Ukraine is trending on this, that Europeans in particular need to rethink?
Well, I think it's not just Ukraine, but also the United Kingdom. That topic has been quite top of the agenda recently, with the UK Army not being up to standard, not being able to recruit the sufficient number of soldiers, and that the conscription is not going that well, that the UK defence is not quite ready for another Third World War or the nuclear war. There have been multiple reports on that in the media recently, and several reports in the House of Commons, in the Defence Committee going through. So I think the United Kingdom, Europe in general, is rearming itself. If you look at the strategy, the newly found strategy by the German government, who's been pacifist for about half a century, and how they're rethinking that. So I think it's just a matter of time for Australia to get up to speed, and I'm sure that they will, because the threats, as Laurie has rightly mentioned, in the region are quite immense. I mean, the agreement of AUKUS that was mentioned, with the UK, US and Australia working on nuclear submarines as a deterrent, is quite successful and has been quite successful so far. I hear there is some gossip in the media that potentially Japan might want to join that alliance. So it only shows that Indo-Pacific is strengthening itself. With the Quad, with President Biden getting South Korea and Japan in Camp David again to reiterate that agreement with the states there. And of course, with the growing influence of China, even though their economic might be declining these days, or at least standing still, if that's safe to say, and India being on the rise, it's going to be very interesting to watch those dynamics in the region. But still, I think we all need to be prepared, because China, according to more and more journalistic investigations, is supplying covertly some weapons to Russia, is supporting the war in Ukraine, not openly, but again, to reiterate it, covertly. So it is that actor that's watching closely what's happening in the world, which power is winning or losing, and which side it needs to take.
Well, we should note, just before we move on, that China's response to all this from their foreign ministry spokesman, Lin Jian, is that China, I quote, poses no threat to any country. So it's all fine, basically. To Turin now, and attempts to address what seems like a self-solving problem, i.e. that of creating distance between those who insist on belching clouds of malodorous smoke and those who do not. Turin has banned outdoor smoking unless other people are at least 5 metres away, on pain of a €100 fine. Here in the UK, meanwhile, MPs have voted aye on a new regime of incremental age-related bans on the sale of cigarettes, with a view to effectively eradicating smoking. Under this law, people born after 2009 will never be able to legally purchase a packet of 20. Laurie, first of all, as regular listeners may have gleaned by now, this is an area on which I am one of life's absolutely blood and thunder illiberals. Not only did I favour banning smoking indoors and herding smokers onto the footpath, I would then have been in favour of routinely turning fire hoses on them. Where are you on this?
Well, I'm quite close to the fire hose camp. I mean, you know, in terms of the public health benefits, you know, any way you look at it, discouraging people from taking up smoking has to be a pretty important thing, just in terms of the human cost of that. But I mean, to be frank, I mean, this feels to me like one of those rather strange things that happens at the end of a parliament. my instant reaction is, you know, laudable though the aim may be, good luck with that. There are at least two problems here. You know, one is around the the freedom to do yourself harm, if that's what you want to do, that one I think is not a particularly big mountain to climb. I mean, you know, the state legislates all the time to prevent people doing harm to themselves mm-hmm. and others. I mean, you know, replace the word tobacco with heroin and see what happens in that argument. The bigger one is enforceability. You know, it's in my view, highly damaging to pass legislation that you can see at the time you're passing it, you haven't got a hope of enforcing effectively.
Well, on that subject, because the Turin regime, Aliona, does also include vaping, and that, you don't need to look too far to see here in London, is something which is getting under the traditional bans of smoking because people can do that very quickly and then just stick it back in their pocket. It is now quite common to see people vaping in pubs, on buses, on the tube, and in lots of other places where it is generally understood that you cannot smoke.
I have some colleagues in the office, pardon me, but being a managing director, maybe this is inappropriate, vaping sneakily in the office because they just can't get away from it and they justify it as, you know, not taking time off of work to go out for a smoke. I think, of course, I'm a little bit torn between liberalism and giving people the free will to choose mm-hmm. for their own, but also I think installing good habits into society is a good thing. The most troubling thing about vaping is, of course, the influence it has on kids with the branding and all mm-hmm. the colorful packaging and all the rest. So, yes, as a woman and hopefully one day a mother, I would ban it without a second thought.
Just a final thought on this, Laurie. I do like that observation you made about what happens at the end of parliaments and laws getting passed that nobody has any real ambition or indeed hope of policing. But does the intention nevertheless carry some weight here? This is a laudable statement by a Prime Minister who may have understood that his chances of building a significant legacy are slender, but this would not be nothing, would it?
Yeah, there's a point there, but I really come back to something that Aliona said. I mean, if you want to change behaviour in an area like this, legislation, particularly legislation that requires vendors to distinguish between, you know, is somebody 44 or 45 a couple of years down the road, that strikes me as less likely to produce the result you're looking for than education. Explaining to people what they're doing to themselves, what they're doing to their children, the people around them, the cost to society of that, and, you know, winning the argument.
Well, on that hopeful note, Sir Laurie Bristow and Aliona Hlivko, thank you both for joining us. Next on today's show, our On This Day historical feature reflects on one of the proverbial geostrategic balls-ups. When one arrives in any political office, high among the stuff near the summit of your in-tray will be ideas had, endeavours conceived, projects commenced by your predecessor. Many of your first decisions will be about consigning the obviously deranged follies to the dustbin to spare the dollars of the taxpayers and the embarrassment of the nation, or pushing ahead with the brighter and or bolder ideas in the hope of reaping all the credit for yourself. In November 1960, John F. Kennedy won the US presidential election. In January 1961, he took the oath and delivered one of the most resonant of inaugural addresses. Everybody remembers this bit, and so they should.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
But this was the important line.
Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
In between election and inauguration, Kennedy had been brought up to speed on a few things by the Central Intelligence Agency. One of these was a plan approved by his predecessor, President Dwight Eisenhower, in early 1960. Vexed by Fidel Castro's communist revolution in Cuba in 1959, Ike had signed off on the CIA's idea of tooling up a bunch of vindictive Cuban exiles, training them in the jungles of Guatemala, and then facilitating their invasion of Cuba with a view to removing Castro and, presumably, reinstalling a government more sympathetic to the US, like the cabal of dismal crooks Castro had toppled in the first place.
¿Cuál era la alternativa del gobierno revolucionario? Traicionar al pueblo.
Kennedy and Eisenhower disagreed on enough that one was a Democrat, the other a Republican. But pathological loathing of Fidel Castro was a bipartisan position in the early 1960s, and would indeed remain so, at the risk of giving away the ending, another half century and change. Besides which, Kennedy may have reasoned, the US had developed considerable expertise in unloading inconvenient Latin American regimes. Honduras, Nicaragua, Haiti, Dominican Republic, Costa Rica. How hard could it be? On April 17, 1961, the invasion went ahead. The intended beachhead was the Bahia de Cochinos, the Bay of Pigs. In the event, the Breakfast of Pigs would have been more accurate.
The assault has begun on the dictatorship of Fidel Castro. Cuban army pilots opened the first phase of organized revolt with bombing raids on three military bases.
Pretty much everything that could go wrong did. The Intendant Preparatory Air Support, a squadron of vintage American B-26 bombers launched from Nicaragua and painted in Cuban Air Force livery, hadn't been able to find their targets. Plans for the seaborne landing had not considered the coral reefs on which several of the invaders' ships foundered. Paratroopers dispatched as reinforcements landed in the wrong place, none of which was more important than the fact that Castro had known of the plan well in advance, due in no small part to the gossip and boasting of the invaders in the bars and nightclubs of Miami in the months beforehand.
In Cuba itself, the people have been exhorted by Castro to push back the invaders, and 300,000 militiamen have been mobilized. The invasion was successful in its early hours, with Castro, of course, blaming the U.S. Is it the first chink in his armor?
Spoiler alert! No. Despite the early optimism of some contemporary reports, the game was pretty much up within 48 hours. Of the 1,400 members of what had become known as Brigade 2506, more than 100 were killed and more than 1,000 taken prisoner. Castro initially offered to swap them for 500 tractors, but the deal was eventually done nearly 2 years later for $53 million worth of food and pharmaceuticals. When the survivors came home, Kennedy did his eloquent best to style the shambles out.
And I can assure you that it is the strongest wish of the people of this country, as well as the people of this hemisphere, that Cuba shall one day be free again. And when it is, and when it is, this brigade will deserve to march at the head of the free column.
The Bay of Pigs was not the only, or even the silliest, attempt by the United States to depose Fidel Castro. During subsequent decades, sallies against America's Ruritanian nemesis included poison cigars, a booby-trapped conch shell, a contaminated diving suit, exfoliants designed to loosen his beard, hallucinogens which might render the interminable speeches with which Castro enjoyed haranguing his snoring people incomprehensible as well as tedious.
Radiografía de diagnóstico general aplicable a la mayor parte de los países aquí representados.
None of it worked. All of it, indeed, arguably had an effect opposite to the intended. The more the US isolated and persecuted communist Cuba, the more unbudgeably entrenched Castro became. Later in 1961, Kennedy speechwriter Dick Goodwin bumped into Castro's glamorous, if thuggish, Argentinian Lieutenant Che Guevara at a cocktail party in Punta del Este in Uruguay. Guevara, who was not without a sense of humour, offered his thanks to the United States for staging the Bay of Pigs. It had served Castro a tremendous political victory, Guevara said, transforming Cuba from an aggrieved little country, as he put it, to an equal. Not for the last time, Earth's mightiest superpower, seeking to impose its will on a much weaker antagonist and possibly blinded by its own strength, had hamstrung itself, akin to a giant attempting to swat wasps with a mallet. For Monocle Radio, I'm Andrew Muller. Finally on today's show, all week our team is on the ground at the Design and Furniture Fair Salone del Mobile, broadcasting from our pop-up studio at House of Switzerland. Another brand also on full display in Milan this year is IKEA, exploring the theme of my first place, what it's like to be young, experiencing your first moving out. Marcel Bingham is IKEA's art director. He spoke to Monocle's Europe editor-at-large, Ed Stocker, about the exhibition.
This year's exhibition is all about the first place, and we're looking at this generation's reality of finding a first home and what that entails. The exhibition itself is made up of a few components. We have a more conceptual part which is brought to life with a maze. The maze is a labyrinth of life and finding a first place. It's within it, we've worked with the creators from both Japan, the UK, and Italy. There's different elements of storytelling from them about what a first place journey looks like today. What are the items you first unpack that make home a home? Then we have the main stage area, which where we're showcasing our new live studio. We have two different product launches. One is a gaming range, because we've seen also with this generation a prolific rise in gaming. And we've also... the last of our Nittelwerket range has been released, which is Klippern and Poang. And Klippern is like one of the most affordable sofas on earth. So it's like, you know, been to the foundation for many first homes, you might say. Aside from that, we did a research project with Dazed Media, and that was also looking into what this generation looks like. What are the different types of living? One of the more interesting things was a group of people who've taken over a closed down hospital in London. So, I mean, interesting creative ways of finding, you know, how to find a home of your own.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? It's super interesting because obviously a brand like IKEA, everyone knows, but it sounds like a lot of work every year in a way to sort of challenge yourself to think of a new way to present what you do and to open the conversation. Yeah. How is it?
Well, one of the things with IKEA is that we're constantly curious. And it's so we want to understand the way that people are living. And that, you know, we're obviously aware that that's constantly changing. There's no constants there. So we want to understand how they live. We want to tell their stories. And also, I mean, because our products are, you know, accessible and affordable, but designed well, we want to show how they can support a better everyday life.
I mean, obviously, you know, a lot of conversations are taking place during this design week, which you'd expect. But tell me why IKEA comes here. Why does it feel it needs to have a presence here? Is it a little bit like you were saying before, this desire to have conversation about themes that seem to be constants for the brand, like making design more democratic, accessible, etc.?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, very much so. And I think every industry has a forum to come together. And for us, Milan Design Week is the most relevant one. It is where we see, you know, the world of, you know, design leaders coming together and setting that agenda for the year ahead or the, you know, multiple years ahead. So I think it is important to be here. And yeah, we have a long history here. We've been coming, you know, for many, many years. And the past three have been, you know, consecutive. So we're trying to keep that momentum.
That was IKEA's art director Marcel Bingham speaking to Monocle's Ed Stocker. If you are in Milan, do stop by Monocle's pop-up studio at House of Switzerland. That is all for this edition of The Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Aliona Livko and Sir Laurie Bristow. Today's show was produced by Tom Webb and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Sarah Nicol. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.